namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa aparuta te sangam tassa dwara yeso tvanto punjanto sudhanti. The Pali word anicca, which we usually translate impermanence in Thai, the normal rendering is maitiang, which means something like not straight, not correct, I guess not permanent or something. But Ajahn Chah very famously used to prefer to say mané, or in the Isan dialect he said bonéron, which means it's not sure. No, it's not a sure thing. Or else you could translate it as maybe not. So whatever happens and you say maybe not. Maybe it's not the way that you think it is. Maybe it's not the way that it seems that it is. And Ajahn Chah gave one of the most succinct and powerful definitions one time when somebody came and asked him, Bhante, what's right view? And he just pointed to said, "This, look at this cup. See this cup? It's broken already, Dak Lao. So the cup is broken already, even though it's a whole cup. And this is the right view." So this is that understanding of impermanence which Ajahn Chah was sharing in Buddhism, in the Abhidhamma schools of Buddhism. They came to understand impermanence as meaning momentariness, the idea that all the kind of the atomic phenomena of the mind and body arise and pass away instantaneously without any duration, and to actually distinctly formulate this kind of presentation of reality became one of the distinctive agendas of the Abhidhamma schools. But when we look at how the Buddha presented teachings on impermanence, he didn't do it in that way. He didn't need to invoke the idea of momentariness in order to talk about impermanence. And so for the Buddha, as for Ajahn Chah in that example, the teaching of impermanence was about things that matter. It's about things that are real, things that belong in our experience. This cup, it's broken already. So when we accept, for example, a new cup, somebody gives us a gift of a new cup, and the Buddha said this is the difference between a foolish, unenlightened person and a wise, noble being. A foolish, unenlightened person gets the gift and thinks, wow, that's ripper. Fantastic. So for example, today you received very unexpectedly and out of the blue a very kind offer of many nice pieces of furniture, which one of our supporters moving house in very kindly made these very fine pieces of furniture available to the monastery for our use. And so the normal reaction to that is to say, oh, that's lovely, some nice bits of furniture, some nice things to have, to hold, to cherish, to delight in, things that can be our precious. And this is how the foolish, unwise, unskilled ordinary person, or as Ajahn Jayasaro liked to translate, the yo-yo. This is what the yo-yo does. They call it a yo-yo because they're always spinning round and round and going up and down and never getting anywhere, and tied onto that string. It's a very good analogy of our existential status according to Buddhism. If we look at the analogy of the yo-yo, I think it should become one of the key metaphors for understanding our lives. So for the ordinary unenlightened yo-yo, as we go around spinning round and round and going up and down on our string of craving but never getting anywhere, then when we get these things, we always get very happy, and it causes a lot of delight, a lot of joy, and that's where life's joys come from. And we think we're going to be happy because we get things, and we get new things, we get a new bit of furniture, a new cup, some delicious food, a new kuti, we get a nice new big cave to delight in. And you always notice, of course, that different people have different kinds of defilements, don't we? The young girls delight in having nice pretty clothes and flowers and ribbons in their hairs and makeup and so on. boys delight in having Xboxes and MP3 players and so on. The monks delight in having nice robes and caves and whatever. Everyone has their own particular thing that they like to delight in and that they regard as very precious to them. And so when we get those things, we don't reflect on them. We just think about getting and not reflecting on the dangers. And so the Buddha always said to understand something deeply meant to understand every side of it. It doesn't mean to ignore the good side of things, but to see, he often talked about the three sides, the asada, the adinava, and the nisarana. The asada is the sweet taste, the gratification, the enjoyment of something. What makes it good? What makes it taste nice? What makes it attractive? What makes it alluring? And then the adinava is the danger, the drawback, the dark side. The dark side of this, the dark side of that, the dark side of everything that is, of everything that was and everything that will be. They all have their dark side. And this is what the Buddha invited us to contemplate as well. He didn't invite us to obsess about it. He didn't invite us to reify the darkness of things. So I hope you know what I mean when I say reify. It's a term they use in philosophy. To reify something means to make it too concrete, to make it too real, to turn it from something that is merely true into something that is really, truly, woolly real. This is what to reify means. And that's what sometimes you see in Buddhism people do with the dark side. They like to reify it. For example, there's one old school of Buddhism called the Kukulikas, or something like that. They actually had the name spelt in many different ways, but one way of spelling it is Kukulika. And the Kukulikas were Kukula, or something like that. It means an ember, a glowing ember. And their main doctrine, their distinctive teaching, was that everything, all sankharas, everything in the world, without exception, was burning and raging like a glowing ember, and that there was no happiness to be found anywhere in the world, that everything we think is happiness is really just these glowing, raging fires. And so this was one particular school of Buddhism that had this idea, and so that school is stressing that dark side to the exclusion of everything else. And because of that, then they're tending to misrepresent the Dhamma, even though it's actually true, even though in one sense, of course, it's true. And as the Buddha said in the fire sermon, everything is burning. And that's a very deeply valid and true way of looking at the world. But it doesn't exhaust our possibilities of how to look at the world. And because the Buddha never denied that there is a happiness in the world, there is a gratification. One famous verse in the Sutta Nipata, Kama hi citra madhura manurama, sensual pleasures are indeed very delightful and pleasing. So if you want to quote the Buddha as saying that, then you can. But with their change and alteration, they distress the mind. That's the next line. So again, it's the same thing as you knowing the bright side and knowing the dark side. Not exclusively focusing on one or the other. So in our way of practice, sometimes it's, since both of these have some truth to them, we in a sense have a choice about which to look at, which to focus on. We can choose to look at the bright side of things, which doesn't deny the dark side of things. We can also choose to look at the dark side of things without denying the bright side of them as well. And this is in one way or one aspect, this is what the practice of samatha and vipassana is about. Samatha, making the mind peaceful, joyful, happy, through looking at the bright side of things, choosing ennobling, illuminating, objects and qualities of mind and physical qualities which are uplifting, which bring joy to the mind. This is what we do in samatha practice. We focus on that bright side and make the mind as sweet and as soft and as happy and as joyful as we can. And then we also do vipassana as well. Vipassana focuses on that dark side. Vipassana looks at what's impermanent, what's ending, what's painful, what's difficult to endure. And so when we look at this alternatively, that bright side and the dark side, in one way we can see that this is impermanence. That the very fact of that, pulsing or cycling through the seasons of the mind in contemplating these different ways, that in itself is impermanence. So that our deeper understanding of impermanence doesn't just mean, oh, I hear this sound, now it's here and now it's gone and that's impermanent. But it's looking at the way that the mind interreacts and interrelates with phenomena and changes. This is how the mind is. If I look at the blissful, soft, joyful side of the mind and make my mind peaceful through metta meditation, that's how that is. And then when I use my mind in the other way, when I look at pain, if I investigate the pain in my back after I've been sitting meditation for a long time, that's how that is. This is how my mind responds to that. And this is that. So this is how that deeper understanding of vipassana starts to emerge. Not just watching things as they arise and cease, but watching the interdependence of the mind together, the knowing together with the things that are known, and seeing that this is the nature of the mind to be like that. And this is, of course, what Ajahn Chah was pointing to when he said this cup is broken already. Because he wanted you to see that breaking of the cup is not something contingent or accidental which happens to the cup. It's not something which descends on the cup from outside. In the Pali, there's a phrase, viparinama dhamma, and that's often translated in English as being subject to change or subject to alteration. And the word there, dhamma, being used in the sense of being subject to. And when we were reviewing the translation of the Sanyutta Nikaya, I tried to point out to Bhikkhu Bodhi that I didn't like that rendering of subject to, because it almost gave the impression that the changeability or impermanence of something was something outside of the thing itself. If I say I'm subject to something, if I'm subject to taxation or I'm subject to the decisions of a committee, that means I'm under the power of something. And the word dhamma in that context doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that there's some kind of force operating in the world which is going to come along and impermanentize things. It's not going to make them impermanent, but rather that it's things' inherent nature to be impermanent. It's their very way that they are, their very being, is to be impermanent. And so impermanence is not something which is like an optional extra or tacked on. That, of course, is the depth of the Buddha's insight, not merely the kind of trivial insight that things in fact change, that seasons change and so on, but the very deep level insight that this is the nature of being itself, that everything in the world, everything that can, has been, will be, is now, everything that can be within this world of experience has that nature of being conditioned, that nature of changing. And so this is that insight to the Dhamma. And the Buddha called Dhammanvaya, the inference or entailment, understanding, the necessity, the following on, what follows, the following on of the Dhamma, of understanding that natural principle. So normally, of course, we live in our surface world where we just respond and react to stuff that kind of presents itself in our experience, sight, sound, smell, taste, touches and thoughts, memories and so on going on in our mind. And so these things happen to them, they like present a kind of a face, a seeming. And we quite unconsciously take all those seemings, take all those presentations and constitute them into a world. Now this is a process that happens in our minds and it happens all the time. We take the sight, sound, smell, taste, touches and mental objects presented to the mind and we turn them into like a coherent world, like an existing kind of world. It's very much like the kind of the process that, for example, a doll maker would use, making different parts of a doll, an arm, a head, and so on, and put them all together and make the form of a human being, make the form of a person. Or the process that, say, an actor would do to make like the form of an emotion. And they would, you know, change their body posture, their tone of voice, their facial expression, and so on, and create the form of a particular emotion, even though they might not be feeling that emotion at the time. And so this is what our mind is constantly doing. It's creating this form of the world. Now that doesn't mean, I'm not saying that the world either exists or doesn't exist, or both exists and doesn't exist, or neither exists nor does not exist. Okay, I'm not saying any of those things. I'm merely saying that this idea we have of the world is something which is intrinsically embedded in how our minds work and how our minds respond to experience. The idea of a whole coherent world is not something we're actually directly presented by experience, but it's something which we design and we impose on our experience. We could just as easily impose chaos on our experience. In fact, it would be much easier. When we, as foolish, ignorant, unenlightened yo-yos, experience these things, we then kind of delight in them because we take this surface, this presentation to be the essence, what the thing is, and we don't reflect on that. So when we get a delicious food, we don't reflect on the nature of the food, and we consume it with delight and all of these kinds of things, and then we make ourselves sick. And it's interesting, I was speaking with Giles about this a little bit earlier, and they were talking, because Giles works with young people, and they were talking about, you know, having a seminar about anorexia. And you know, some of the interesting things that happen, of course, there's anorexia is a terrible problem affecting mainly young girls who basically starve themselves to death. But the interesting thing is, of course, there's far, far more cases of obesity than there is of anorexia. And the other thing that's interesting is that actually anorexia itself is a disease of affluence. And it's actually almost like the flip side of obesity. It's only because we're afraid of being obese that we would suffer from anorexia. And it's not a kind of disease which one would expect to find in very poor countries where they're having trouble seeking food. But that very perversion of the mind that causes those poor girls, usually girls, to have a completely distorted vision of their own bodies. We look at their bodies and we think they're like a stick figure. And so I was driving through Sydney a couple of weeks ago and we just saw on the side of the road this girl walking along and she was absolutely emaciated, appallingly skinny, and yet when she would look in the mirror she would see somebody who at best is normal and at worst is probably fat or overweight and needs to lose weight. So this kind of, they call dysmorphia, this is where the mind under the influence of its craving takes a visual impulse, which you would think is quite straightforward, wouldn't you? You'd think it's fairly straightforward and obvious to be able to look in the mirror and see one's own body and determine whether you're a normal weight or if you're a bit plump or if you're a bit skinny. But because we have so many attachments bound up to our own mind, we can't do that. And we're actually constantly twisting what we see in the mirror and turning it into something that it's not. Turning it into something which is more ugly than other people see it, or turning it into something that's more beautiful than what other people see it. And so we're always twisting and changing things, like this spin doctor. It's always putting a spin on things. And so this is why we always get bound up in that trap as patujanas, as yo-yos. We always get bound up in that trap of thinking things are going to be permanent, delighting in them when they go well, and then getting very, very sad and upset by them when they go badly. And we like yo-yos up and down, always spinning round and round, tied onto that thread of craving. But of course the enlightened person, someone who's a noble disciple, they understand that dhammanvaya, they understand that that flowing on of the Dhamma, that flow of the Dhamma. This is how things are this way. And so it's when we see things like that, we don't have to wait until things actually manifest impermanence before we understand their impermanence. You see, normally, for example, we might get a new cloth, a new piece of clothing, and we delight in that when it's new. And later on, when it's very old and raggedy and worn out, then we don't delight in it anymore. And so we're happy to give it away or use it as a rag. But if we contemplate things properly, then we would see that that ragginess is actually inherent in the new cloth as well, and so we wouldn't delight in it even when we first get it. We would realize that it's appropriate to use. If it is appropriate, we would realize that it's appropriate and we would use it in the right way, but without getting upset, delighted in it. And that means, of course, we don't get upset about it when it fades away. So this is our understanding of impermanence. And so we have to keep on practicing with this. This is a constant practice. And I think it's much more important to practice with understanding those things that are really meaningful. The things in our lives, the emotional stuff in our lives that actually hurts, that actually causes us pain, causes us suffering. I don't think it's so important to, you know, concern yourselves. I don't think it's necessary for you to do as I've done and read lots of books about Sarvastivadin theory of time and impermanence and try to actually figure out what those guys are saying. Actually, I usually reach the end of those books and it hasn't actually helped me very much to understand my own situation. I just do it out of like a kind of perversity rather than anything else. But, you know, what I do learn out of is when things happen that are very unexpected. And, you know, many things happen, even this last week. That's why I'm talking on this theme, is I can just look back over this last week and think, wow, so many amazing, wonderful things happened, and yet a lot of really terrible things have happened in the last week as well. It's been this kind of real kind of roller coaster up and down. I was just sort of reflecting on that before the talk and thinking, well, actually, I kind of feel okay, surprisingly enough. I didn't really expect to, but it's like, oh yeah, it's all kind of all right, and life goes on somehow. Even we might wish that it doesn't, but somehow it goes on. You know, we want to maybe, you know, people, when these things get very bad, they get very, very serious depression and they want to end life. You know, that's like when it's kind of the focusing on just that dark side incessantly or without without any let up. And so people, if they get that bad, and it's like, oh my goodness, I just want to end life. Of course, that comes from a complete misunderstanding, because life ends anyway. It's the nature of life to end. And the act of ending it is itself a new beginning. So the act, the choice of ending life, is itself a kind of karma, and that karma is the kind of karma which starts a new life, and it's probably not going to start a very happy new life. It's interesting that just talking to Giles in the car on the way down, that from his experience with children with mental disorders, that the ones who are suicidal will very often, if they try to kill themselves, he said they had one young girl at his centre, she tried to get in the car, and her plan was to get in the car and just drive the car, smash it into a wall and kill herself. But fortunately it was a Toyota Prius and it had a very sophisticated system for starting the engine, and she couldn't get it started even though she stole the key. And then the next, she got a rope and put it round her neck and hung herself in the grounds of the place where they're staying at Rivendell, climbed up one of the big trees and hung herself. Unfortunately, she didn't tie the rope onto a high enough branch, and she sort of hit the ground and sort of dangled off it for a while, enough to make some good marks on her neck, and then came into the office and said, "I just tried to hang myself, and here's the rope marks on my neck." When I say that we've had some problems here at the monastery in the last week, or I've had some personal problems in the last week, I don't mean to say there's been anything quite that bad. But this is the kind of the impermanence of it all, isn't it? You know, these things that you can't expect. These things that are, you just, you wake up in the morning, you just got no idea that these kinds of things are going to happen. There's a very good piece of advice in a book, I don't remember what book it was, I think it was one of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, and it said that to make a habit of believing 6 impossible things before breakfast. And this is something I would highly recommend as a mental habit to get into before you have breakfast tomorrow morning. See if you can make yourself believe 6 impossible things. That improves your mental flexibility to try to imagine things that you don't know, that are completely out of the world, they're completely impossible. And you know, when you try to make yourself believe something that's impossible, you notice how your mind protests against it. You notice how there's this kind of not wanting to believe it. I'll just tell you one example of one impossible thing. So I've made a bit of a habit of collecting impossible things to believe in. I'll give you an example of one impossible thing. This was something that was reported in the Philadelphia Inquirer in about the early 1900s. And the article told the story of an expedition to the Grand Canyon, not our Grand Canyon here, but the one in America, and they climbed around through the caves in the Grand Canyon. And maybe this has got something to do with my obsession with caves at the monastery, I don't know, but they climbed and they found this huge cave. And they went in. This was an anthropological expedition from the Smithsonian Institute, the most prestigious scientific institute in America. And they climbed deep into the cave in the Grand Canyon, and it went on for miles. It was a huge complex of caves. And they began to realize that there was a whole lost civilization who had used those caves. And they found all of these artifacts and so on. They found a kind of metal which they couldn't identify, which was untarnished after so many hundreds or thousands of years. And when in the furthest depths of the cave, they came to a huge cavern. And this was obviously like a meeting hall that could have accommodated thousands of people. And in this huge cavern, there at one end of it, what did they see? They saw a Buddha image. Okay, so now I want you to look at your mind protesting about this and saying, hang on, that's impossible. I can't believe that even before lunchtime, much less before breakfast. But is it possible? I don't know. When this article that I read after they contacted, this was an article written much later, written in recent times, and they contacted the Smithsonian Institute and they denied all knowledge of such an expedition. And the that area of the Grand Canyon is now marked a special security zone and no one's allowed to go into it. You can't explore it at all. So you can make of that as you wish. Perhaps it's more likely now that we know that there was a fair degree of likelihood that the Chinese were visiting America before Columbus and so on, so perhaps maybe they did have some Buddha images there. But in any case, it's interesting just to look at how your mind struggles with things like that. You say, well, I'm going to make myself believe that. I'm going to make myself believe that there was a lost civilization in the Grand Canyon who are actually Buddhists. And how this kind of goes against all the ideas and ways you think about things. So I think this is a very good kind of exercise to do. And when you start to put yourself into like different belief shoes, as it were, you realize that these ways of looking at things they themselves are changing. They are impermanent. Even our way of looking at things as Buddhists also is changing, it's impermanent. And even sometimes the people who we might think have very firm and fixed views about certain things, and then if you look at them over a period of many years, now you can see that they're changing, and they're kind of their way of seeing things and so on also is, it's not permanent, it's also subject to change. So this is why Ajahn Chah said something along the lines of, if you think you get upachara samadhi, then you tell yourself it's not certain. If you think you've got jhana, then you tell yourself it's not certain. If you think you're a stream enterer, then you tell yourself it's not certain. If you think you're a once returner, you tell yourself it's just not certain. If you're a non-returner, you're not certain. And if you're an arahant, then that's really not certain. So you just keep on reminding yourself of all of these things. It's mine now. Whatever happens to you in your practice, it's mine now. And then see if you can get that kind of equilibrium where you're not elated and overjoyed. You don't get infatuated when very beautiful and positive, uplifting things, like, for example, like the ordination that we had on last Monday, when that's such a beautiful, inspiring, wonderful, perfect event. But don't get taken away with that. Don't get intoxicated by it. And then when things happen that are distressing or upsetting or depressing, and then also try not to get too affected by those things. And so this is like that third arm, is neither the gratification nor the danger, but the escape. It's the kind of that mysterious third, that something that's neither black nor white. It's neither good nor bad, it's neither wrong nor right. It's something which is beyond all of those kinds of dichotomies. And that kind of mysterious third, in the Abhidhamma they call that the Abhyakata Dhamma, the kind of the undeclared. So this kind of, it's something else. It's not within those ordinary categories and ways of thinking about things. It's something else. This is what gives meaning to those worldly dichotomies. And this is what gives meaning to that perspective of having that balance of contemplating the positive and the negative. If we're just, if that's all there is, if all there is just like delighting in that interplay of the positive and negative, the light and the dark, the happy and the sad, if all there is those cycles and they're just the acceptance or embodiment of it, then there's no real spiritual practice. It's only when that third, we have that perspective of that third, which is neither one nor the other, that's the escape. And this is what gives our life a meaning in terms of the Eightfold Path. It's what gives our life a perspective. There's something else. It's not just getting all the good stuff and getting rid of the bad stuff. It's not about that. It's about something else. Whatever we try to think about it, whenever we try to pin it down, it always wriggles out of our fingers. It always slips out of our grasp because it's something else. And it's that something else which is so subtle and so refined that we can't say it is, we can't say it isn't, we can't say it both is and isn't, we can't say it neither is nor isn't. And yet we know that it is. It certainly is in the sense that it's true, it can be realized. And that's the goal. It's a context that makes our Buddhist practice meaningful. So this is my talk for you this evening on impermanence. I offer that to you for your reflection, and I hope that's been of some benefit for you.